The next matter on our oral argument calendar this morning is State of Minnesota versus Diaz. Counsel, as you're getting squared away, I'll just quickly go over our rules, with which you're both quite familiar. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellant will receive an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal time if you'd like to use it. State your name as you commence each leg of your argument and be mindful of the timing restrictions. And I'm not sure if you were here at the beginning of the last argument, but I'll just repeat that we do have three podiums. You're free to use whichever one you're most comfortable with for health reasons. If you prefer to use the microphone closest to the table, you certainly may, or you may use the large lectern in the middle, whatever you're most comfortable with. Counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready to proceed, you have the floor.
If it may please the court, counsel, Mr. Diaz Cervantes was convicted of a criminal sexual conduct charge following a jury trial in Scott County. I've raised a number of issues in my brief, but I'd actually like to take my time here this morning to focus in on the jury instruction issue, and if we have time, maybe get to the speedy trial issue as well. And I think what's important about the defense closing is you've got to take everything in that closing in context. His counsel, my client's attorney, started out his closing with, and I've got some quotes here, "This just can't be enough. How could it be?" Then he outlined the investigation, who the officers interviewed. He interviewed SV. He sent SV for an examination at MCRC. He checked my client's cell phone and talked to SV's sister, Camilla. Then he outlined what wasn't done. He said they didn't go to the scene of the crime. They didn't take any photographs, didn't attempt to collect any DNA. And he didn't question Camilla about witnessing anything that may have happened in the trailer home, even though she was supposedly present during any and all of these assaults. So then the defense attorney started pointing out inconsistencies of the complainant's testimony and then reiterated that this cannot be enough. So that's the context, and that's why it was error even to give this instruction in the first place.
Can I ask you a big picture question?
Sure.
On your argument before we go much further into the details, but we do want to hear the rest of your argument on the point. Obviously, for your client, you're going to have to establish both that the instruction was error or an abuse of discretion, and also show prejudice under the harmless error doctrine. In your opening brief, the only statement about harmless error is the conclusory statement, as I read it on page 32, and you can correct me if I've missed something, which is the instruction here was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, period. Not elaborated upon, no case law, no facts, no weaving in the harmless error standard and why it's not harmless in this case. And the state emphasizes that you have to show prejudice in its brief, and then the reply brief doesn't go into any other harmless error analysis. Why wouldn't we just treat the harmless error issue as forfeited?
Well, I guess the court could say I didn't elaborate on that issue well enough, but it's certainly raised, and I think the standard is not harmless. It's because it's objected to that if the defendant should be given a new trial if it cannot be said beyond a reasonable doubt that the error had no significant impact on the verdict.
Right, and I don't see an analysis on that part of it, whether it had a significant impact on the verdict and the evidence that was presented and other reasons why it may or may not be harmless.
Well, and I think I argue that it focuses the jury improperly on the testimony of the victim, or SV, rather than all the other evidence that was presented, including evidence presented by the defense.
No, I mean, that shows why there's error. I mean, I get that as to why there might be an error. I'm just trying to get past that to the next step of prejudice.
Well, you never know what goes on in a jury room. So it's hard for us to sit here and dissect it and say why. But I think it's important that the jury, after closing, came back and said, we're 60-40, we want to hear her statement again. So they play her statement again, which is probably proper because they've asked for it. But then with the focus in on her testimony and then replaying her statement, then they return a verdict the next day. This is not a slam dunk case. This is a case where—
Asserting any error in the district court's decision to play that one portion again or not?
No, there's no error in doing that. I think there's a trend going that I don't like where they put the tape player back in the jury room. They brought everyone into the courtroom, played the whole statement. So I think that was properly done. But again, with the instruction saying you can convict based on her testimony alone, that adds to this issue of the error and then why it wasn't harmless, because they brought them out, played that tape again to the jury and to the exclusion of all other evidence.
Counsel, that is the law, though. You can convict based on the testimony of a single witness, yes?
There is a statute that says that. Whether it should be used in a trial court setting is another question, because that statute doesn't define a crime or set a penalty. It's a procedural statute, and I would suggest it violates the separation of powers if it comes into a...
And there was an objection to the instruction?
Yes.
So then my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's your burden to prove that it was error, and then the burden shifts to the state to establish that it was not harmless.
Correct. Okay. And I think it's error. I mean...
It's error, but it was in response to an argument that was made to the jury, which suggested that the testimony of a single witness is not sufficient under law to sustain a conviction.
Well, that's what I was trying to point out in the context of the argument, is that in this case, the testimony of that one witness wasn't sufficient. So that's why I was trying to give some context. It wasn't a blanket statement of law that you can never convict on the testimony of one witness. And it is error. I mean, this court in Johnson said, don't give this instruction.
Well, I'm trying to square this case with your position in this case with Johnson. So here's the language that I'd like you to address in Johnson in relation to this case. It's on page 388 of the Johnson decision. When the challenged instruction, which is similar to the instruction, not the same, but similar to the instruction here, is considered in conjunction with the district court's proper instruction of the jury on the state's burden of proving its case beyond a reasonable doubt, we do not find prejudicial error. And in this case... If we were to agree with you that the instruction itself was error, why wouldn't this exact statement fit this case?
Your Honor, just a matter of luck, I've got that same paragraph quoted in my notes. If you go up further, the instruction given in Johnson was significantly different. The opinion continues, here the court instructed the jury as follows. The testimony of an alleged victim need not be corroborated, but a lack of corroboration may be relevant consideration in determining believability. The state contends that, well, the first clause may be considered error, the second clause favors Johnson and offsets the error. We agree. The instruction given by the court here was not the one given in Johnson. It was the first part of the sentence. So we don't even have the benefit of that second clause in Johnson.
Well, the tough thing, and the other tough part of the error, I think, and thank you for that response. One difficult part, I think, in your position is the one that Judge Larkin is touching on, that it feels like there was a concern in the district court that the argument that was made needed a response, that the jury might construe the defense argument as one witness's statement is not enough. And so we can have a curative instruction, there's different ways to respond to it. And I'm trying to understand why this particular response to it, well, first of all, do you agree that it's within the district court's discretion to respond to what might appear from the district court's perspective to be misleading potentially to the jury on the question of whether one witness is sufficient?
I mean, generally, yeah, but I think you would have to do it in a manner that doesn't highlight or point out or improperly instruct the jury.
What would that instruction look like in this case?
Well, actually, Your Honor, I'm going to jump back and not answer your question, because I think the prosecutor effectively rebutted that argument on the rebuttal. The rebuttal was, he starts off, this cannot be enough. As if this offense, such as a personal, private nature committed amongst family members in the privacy of their home, lends itself to more. By its nature, the selection of the individual target for the abuse, it doesn't. It lends itself to a testimony of one girl as to what happened to her, and that is absolutely enough to find the defendant guilty. That's an effective rebuttal as I've seen to that position. So I don't think the court even needed to get to the instruction, because whatever argument.
Aren't you arguing that it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because of the way that the state had already done it? If we excise the curative instruction, how do we know it would be different?
No, Your Honor, I think the problem is that it was effectively rebutted by the state, but then the court endorsed this by giving that instruction.
Well, in Johnson, going back to the other distinction, is this connection to using it in determining believability. Do you see anything in the district court's instruction here that is similar to that part of the instruction in Johnson?
You mean like the general believability of a witness? That they gave the pattern jury instructions, if that's where the court is asking. There was no specific.
Well, the district court also said the testimony of a single witness may be sufficient if believed.
Right.
And so I'm wondering if that part of the instruction makes this close enough to tying to believability that it would we could reach the same conclusion.
No, because I think, again, it's the focus on the testimony of one witness. I guess if believed beyond a reasonable doubt, maybe we're getting closer, but it's not if believed. I think if believed to that, the burden of proof.
Well, I should have kept going. If believed, comma, to meet the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah. That helps. It makes it less offensive, but I think it's a problematic instruction. And I don't know that the state can prove that it didn't affect the verdict. The other issue I just want to, if we're done, I just touch on real quickly is the speedy trial issue, because while we were briefing, Page came out, and I think the state just blanketly asserts that Page says that the COVID delays don't count against the state. I think the timing here on this case is very important, because Judge Gilday's order allowed jury trials in specific situations to commence on, I think that was November 20th, 2020, on certain conditions. The chief judge had to petition Justice Gilday to get permission. And apparently the permission was not granted. We don't know why. It happened in some conversation off the record. But Judge Wilton's comments and about the courtrooms are too small, I think is really troubling, and that there's not enough space. I don't know if there's an asterisk to the speedy trial right that says only if it's in a metropolitan courtroom with a big enough room.
Well, I think the judge's comments were, I mean, in a different world than before COVID, those comments certainly would not mean much. But in the context of COVID, where social distancing was the term of the day, and there was a concern, no one knew at that time about transmissibility. We didn't have near the knowledge that we have now.
Sure.
I mean, I think that's the context of the district court's comments, not just that, or concern about the size of the courtroom, not just a general concern about courtroom size. Do you read it the same way?
Well, I think the context is we don't have courtrooms big enough to allow social distancing to have trials.
Right.
But I get my concern is that it doesn't seem like there's much effort taken in Scott County. The judge's order said if the parties or the defendant can come up with a space and have deputies and do all that sort of stuff to come up with a space for trial, they'd do it. But boy, that doesn't seem to be the right person to lay that burden on. It would seem to be court administration or the court to come up with a solution. And so I think the speedy trial right issue starts running on November 20th when the court allows these jury trials. He's in custody. He's got a speedy. I know the state makes some complaint about when the speedy is asserted. I do this all the time. If I get a date certain, I assert a speedy trial 60 days from that date to block it in. I don't necessarily do that at the first opportunity.
What do you make of this discussion from the Supreme Court? It's before Page and Mickle on this, the seriousness with which an attorney asserts the speedy trial right. You have to evaluate how serious they are, because I think acknowledging that many times attorneys do it as a matter of routine, and they're not that serious about asserting a speedy trial right. So, I mean, you just said you do it all the time. How do we determine whether in this case the assertion was a serious one?
And I guess I do it all the time when I have a serious felony with a date certain, so that if my date certain gets changed for some reason, I have a recourse for my client. So maybe I was maybe a little too flip in that comment, but they reasserted it every time they made a motion for a dismissal for a speedy trial. So I don't know how more you could reassert it. So, Your Honor, with that, we'd ask that the court grant Mr. Diaz-Cervantes a new trial.
Thank you. And you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal time. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Todd Zettler. I represent respondent, state of Minnesota. The appellant has raised essentially five or six issues, the last issue being if none of the previous issues are enough, then a combination of all of these issues should be enough to reverse. And I've responded to all of these in detail in the state's brief. And none of these are errors, and none of these are sufficient to reverse alone or in combination.
Can I start with where Judge Ross, I guess, began, and wondering what your position is on whether or not the appellant or defendant can forfeit the prejudice part of under our doctrine?
I think if you don't argue it on appeal, yes, you can forfeit it.
No, even though it's the state's burden. Sorry.
No, go ahead, same point.
Even though it's the state's burden, yes. But I think that there was no prejudice in any case. I mean, if you look at the case law as it pertains to this corroboration instruction, no case reverses, none. So even if you were to get to it, there is not a reversible error when it is a correct instruction under the law. And it is a correct instruction of the law.
Do I read your brief correctly that you're at its fundamental point, the state disagrees with Williams and Johnson on this point?
Yes. So I lay out four pretty succinct ways to get there. First, none of the cases address specifically a jury instruction in a misstatement of the law by the defense, number one. Number two, this court has distinguished those cases in the past when necessary, frankly, when, like in Hansen, where it was okay to be argued by the prosecutor but not okay to be a jury instruction. That makes no sense. That's simply distinguishing to reach the result. Third, none of the cases find the error to be sufficient to reverse when it's a correct instruction of the law. And finally, yes, Johnson relied on Williams, and Williams is wrong. It's never been adopted by the Minnesota Supreme Court, and this court should reconsider it if it comes to that.
Now, I didn't see a full-throated argument with the rationale for us to reverse Williams in your brief. I mean, you challenge it as being improper, but just to be clear on what you're arguing, if we're going to reverse or overrule one of our own decisions and the principles of stare decisis and oblige us to not just look at it and say, well, we think it's wrong, but compellingly so. And I don't think you attempt to make that argument in your brief. If I've missed it, then correct me.
No, I mean that this court should reverse it. It makes no sense. It was, and what I state in my brief is true, that it is the first case to find this distinction between evidentiary versus substantive instruction to the jury. I'd never seen that prior to that case. The Supreme Court sort of mentions it in two decisions and certainly does not endorse it in either. Therefore, there's really no basis for this court to continue and certainly not to reverse the state in a case like this when the jury is correctly instructed otherwise on the burden of proof, on the elements of the offense, and really on every other thing in the case. And I guess the last thing I would say is that when appellant was speaking, he indicated that it needed to be proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and that is exactly what the district court instructed the jury, that the testimony of a single witness may be sufficient, if believed, to meet the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And then the court followed all of the other normal instructions on proof beyond a reasonable doubt and explained that to the jury. There's no credible argument that this jury was confused on what the law was. I would ask this court to not find error in that instruction in this case.
Are you concerned at all about the if believed, that, well, if you believe the testimony, does that imply that it necessarily meets the reasonable doubt standard? It doesn't, the qualification isn't quite as thorough as the qualification in the Johnson instruction with regard to reasonable doubt.
I mean, the qualification is obviously favorable to the defense because that is, I mean, really, that's the law. There's nothing else that needs to be said. It's not an improper instruction on the law. And a district court abuses its discretion when its jury instruction materially misstates the law when read as a whole. That does not do that. That does not materially misstate the law when read as a whole. So the district court did not abuse its discretion. Unless the court has any other questions on that issue, I will turn to the speedy trial. And simply note that Page does control the outcome of this case. There's no material distinction between Page and the various elements in this case.
The length is a bit different. I mean, it's quite a bit longer here.
The length is different, that's true. But the delay, I mean, really after you get...
And I don't recall, was Page incarcerated? Was it incarceration case? Is this? I just don't remember that detail. Do you?
I believe so. I'm not positive on that. It was 100-some days, so probably. This was about 317 from the first demand. But there were various reasons why it was continued. It wasn't solely the COVID orders. So, for instance, the defense attorney had to COVID quarantine. That was one of the delays. One of the witnesses had to COVID quarantine. That was another delay. And then at that point, all the trials were barred. So that then falls straight within Page. As far as the assertion of the speedy trial, he did demand it later after not demanding it initially. This case is a little bit different because the state also joined a demand for a speedy trial, and we were still unable to get one because of COVID. I mean, that falls right within Page.
But what factor, or who in whose favor does that factor weigh? Are you conceding that that would weigh in favor of the defense, that it was asserted with enough seriousness to...
I think that that does weigh in the defendant's favor in this case. As far as prejudice, he has failed to identify any prejudice, allege any prejudice, even in his reply brief. And as Page explains, when there's no other explanation why the trial delay itself hampered his defense, his impaired defense argument lacks merit. So the most significant element of prejudice is if actual defense is impaired, and there's no evidence of that in this case, just as there was no evidence of it in Page. So when you balance those factors, the district court correctly found that there was not a speedy trial violation. Unless the court has any questions on any of the other issues, I would simply ask this court to affirm the district court in all respects. Thank you.
Do not appear to be any additional questions from the panel.
Thank you.
Counsel for Appellant, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
I just...
And again, for the record, go ahead and begin with your name.
Sure. Charles Clippert.
Thank you.
in rebuttal here for Mr. Diaz-Cervantes. I guess I have a hard time with the state not conceding that this instruction was wrong. We have two published Court of Appeals opinions saying don't do this. So I don't, they may disagree. We disagree with a lot of decisions, but we still follow them.
Am I correct that in neither of those cases was there even the colorable basis to suggest that the instruction was responsive or corrective to statements that were made by the defense counsel during closing argument?
I do not remember that aspect of in either case. I don't think it's present. At least it wasn't part of the opinion.
You would agree, I assume, but disabuse me if I'm wrong about it, that if we were to read the circumstances to suggest that there was a basis for a curative instruction, that would bear upon not the prejudice prong, but even the error prong.
I think it's error to give this instruction no matter what.
Even if it's curative?
Correct. Because it's...
So if a defense counsel gets up and says categorically, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, as a matter of law, you cannot convict on the word of one witness, that then would mean categorically the court could not step in and instruct the jury that no, you can, that the testimony of one witness, if believed, could be sufficient to establish proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
I think there's a better way of doing it. I think the better way of saying it is the court could admonish the jury that you need to consider all the evidence presented before the court to determine whether the state's met their burden of proof.
Let's agree that that's a better way to do it, but does that mean that it's legal error for the district court to step in? And when I say error, it's abuse of discretion.
The problem with the statute, again, it's the legislature stepping into the court to tell the courts how to run their show. And so
it's not just the legislature. Courts have said over and over again, I know I've written in opinions, I've seen it in many opinions where our court says in response to a challenge to sufficiency of the evidence, even the testimony of one witness is sufficient to meet the proof beyond a reasonable doubt standard.
Sure.
So it's not a misstatement of law.
Sure, but it's a standard of review on a sufficiency case. The Johnson case that the parties discuss at the sidebar is actually a sufficiency of the evidence case. So that's very different. It's a very deferential standard of review to the evidence presented to the jury.
Mr. Clippert, when you say there are two cases that say don't do it, are you referring to Williams as one of the two?
Yes, Williams and Johnson.
So did our court decide in Williams that it was erroneous?
If I remember right, I think the court in Williams said it was error, but it didn't warrant a new trial. But at some point, if the district courts are going to keep doing this in the face of precedential opinions, then it's going to cause, at some point, this court may have to overrule just based on the erroneous instruction. But I think you can do it here because of the erroneous instruction and the prejudice. So with that, and I guess, Judge, my point about it being wrong is that, again, this is a separation of powers issue. This is the legislature telling the court how to run their show. I think it's interesting that it's
the statute is, but why can't the court tell the court how to run the show? Why would it matter if the legislature simply agrees with what the court is asserting, which is you only need one witness? And I don't think you're not disputing that as a matter of law, that one witness's testimony is enough.
No. The problem is, Judge, is that this statute is specific to a crimsex. And I've only seen this come up in crimsex cases. I've never seen it come up in a domestic case.
But in any case, it may be statutorily connected to crimsex, but I know that in more than crimsex cases, this court has said the testimony of only one witness is sufficient.
Sure. But again, the statute is specific to a crimsex. And again, that's why I've only seen this come up in a jury instruction in relation to crimsex cases.
But if it's a correct statement of law in every case.
But it's that whole issue about, what was the case that Olson, I think, is the one I mentioned in my brief, where you have presumptions. It's the same sort of thing. You shouldn't be giving the jury instructions that highlight specific pieces of evidence. It should be evidence as a whole. So with that, we'd ask for a new trial, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel, Mr. Klippert, Mr. Zettler. Well argued, as always. We appreciate your written arguments, your oral arguments today, very helpful to us. The matter is submitted. We'll issue the opinion within our statutory period. Thank you both. Have a good afternoon.